Welcome to Q&A, a queer and alternative podcast brought to you by GCN, Ireland's national LGBT press in Ireland. As part of our inaugural global edition of GCN, all about the environmental crisis, we got together with Extinction Rebellion Ireland in the Project Arts Centre to host an evening of information and conversation about the crisis and how each of us can help effect meaningful change to reverse the damage done to our planet. Here's a flavour of the evening.
Evening all. Can't see anybody, so I'll just say hello. My name is John. I guess I'm kind of middle-aged and middle-class and kind of male and stuff, so probably all the things you don't expect to be here. And people who look like me, mostly people who look like me, pretty much created most of the problems that I'm about to talk about, so I'm part of that shared guilt. And I'm also, I guess, I've run my own business for the last, 20-something years. I was got started in my teens, don't worry. So I suppose I've kind of looked at the system from both sides. For me, as an individual, this system has been fantastic. It has given me all the opportunities, the good life, whatever you're having yourself, okay? However, there's a catch. And the catch is that the same system that has given people who look like me all the good things, all the opportunities, all the advantages, that same system is also going to kill us all. No exaggeration, it's going to kill us all. That system, continuing on its current trajectory, it's not going to work. It's simply not going to work for humans. So, however, it is a bit of a paradox. We're going to start with this headline. This is very low tech. This headline from the New York Times, right? I think it's great. It says, "Why 2018 was the best year in human history." By a guy who looks like me. He says, "Once again, the world's population was living longer and living better than ever before." And in a sense, for guys who look like me, this is true. But there's plenty of other people for whom 2018 wasn't so great. Or 2017, and indeed 2019. And this is just, by the way, within the one species on Earth that is actually doing great. The other millions of species, not so good. So, as I say, these guys, very good. These guys, not so good. I think it's very important to say that this, while this crisis affects us all, the causes are very unequally distributed. And certain type of people, mostly people who look like me, we have contributed disproportionately. And also, we're the ones, by and large, who are resisting change furiously and resisting response to this furiously. So, anyway, I guess that's sort of that part of it. Couple of headlines here, I guess you'd be familiar with some of them. The first one you can probably see fairly well. It's called "The Insect Apocalypse Is Here." This doesn't mean they're taking over, just to be clear. Insects, arthropods, are very hardy. They've survived everything that nature has thrown at them for hundreds of millions of years. In fact, you really, really want to get to an earth-crushing level event before insects start to disappear en masse. Insects are disappearing en masse all over the world. This is probably, to my mind, if a greater red-letter warning than any polar bear balancing on a piece of ice. These are the charismatic creatures that you tend to associate with climate breakdown. But the reality is, these guys hold the whole system together. And if they're in crisis, the system's in crisis. And the headline above it, it says, "Farming under threat as soil fertility falls 40% in 10 years. Now, ask yourself, how can something fall 40% in 10 years? And then I cast my mind back to the year that I started in primary school. You take that year as a baseline, and we take 2020. We take those 2 points, okay? Between those 2 points, the total number of wild land-based animals in the world has declined from the year I started in primary school to basically next year, if you take that as a measuring unit, by somewhere between 60 and 66%. So two-thirds of all the wild animals in the world gone in my lifetime or a portion of my lifetime. Now, that begs the question. I've got two teenagers. So, what's left for them? And I know that sounds kind of selfish and a bit whiny on my part, but maybe that's probably what brought me to focus on this in the first place. Because as soon, you know, you start seeing it through your kids' eyes, and next thing you're looking out into 2030, 2040, 2050. And suddenly, while it might feel good to say, well, this is not my problem, it most assuredly is their problem. I had a conversation recently with an academic from one of the universities who wanted to, well, we talked about a number of things, including grief around this issue. And she made a really interesting point, which I don't think I've actually said out loud since. She's a bit younger than me, but anyway, she said she finds herself walking down the street, looking at faces as they go past. And she said her eyes kind of light on old people. And she said, I envy them. An extraordinary thing. And I actually know exactly what she means. The people, the last generation to die in their beds, surrounded by their families, with the health system propping them up. Unfortunately, that's a luxury that is disappearing. And anyone in this room under the age of 40? Anyone in? Hang on, let me check. Oh, shit. Okay. Anyone in this room under the age of 40? Even under the age of 50? Unfortunately, this is the reality that we all have to contend with. So, now, I'll continue if I may. Now, two headlines here. The first one is from June 24, 1988. And it says, scientists say the greenhouse effect is setting in. So that's about 30 years ago or so. That was part of a presentation to the US Congress at the time. So then we fast forward 30 years, and we have climate scientists are struggling to find the right words for very bad news. They told us, we didn't listen. They told us, we carried on. From 1988 to 2019, humans have released more emissions into the atmosphere than for the previous 10,000 years combined. This is when we're on notice that we're in the middle of an existential crisis. What do? We doubled down. Oh, and by the way, there's lots of innocent parties in this, but there's lots of guilty bastards too. For example, the fossil fuel industry. Since 2015, since the Paris Agreement, has spent between them $1 billion a year spreading lies and misinformation about the reality of climate change. And that's why so many people remain so confused about this issue. And something, as a media person, I find incredibly frustrating, that we're up to here in this crisis that is going to kill billions of people and exterminate millions of species, and we're still asking stupid questions like, well, maybe it's the sun. Right? It isn't. We've got to move on past that. But even that, we're still, like, we're stuck in amber, arguing about silly questions that we should have moved on past a long, long time ago. And that's a shame. But that didn't happen. And I emphasise that. That didn't happen by accident. So, this is a headline from the 30th of April, just yesterday. Crowded out of existence. 1 million species at risk of extinction because of human activities. 1 million species. Now, somebody describes species, the way to think about them, because of course they cover, it's right across the natural kingdom. The way to think about them is the way you might think about the rivets on the wing of an airplane. There's loads of them. And lots of them actually aren't that terribly important, but some of them are really important. They keep the airplane up. The problem is, we don't really know which parts of the natural kingdom we can pulverize and flatten without one keystone species collapsing, leading to an ecosystem collapse, leading to further collapse. We haven't a clue because I suppose we've been too busy doing what we do, which is consuming and expanding, to even consider it. And to suggest, by the way, and this again is something that sort of strikes me as very odd, to suggest that there is any limits to our entitlements is met with indignation and fury. I'll give you an example. I wrote about this in the Irish Times a couple of months ago, and I put forward what I thought was a fairly neutral suggestion. And the suggestion was that we introduce, connected to your PPS number, in Ireland and across Europe and elsewhere, hopefully in time, a system where everybody is allocated a ration of air miles. I suggested 1,500 kilometres a year. That's it, okay? You get that at the normal price, and after that and above that, you get absolutely hammered. Well, that was fair enough. So I went on to a radio programme to talk about it, and the host said to me afterwards, he said, the theme, he said, that came through more than any other theme in the texts and the phone calls that came into the show was, they'd like to chop your ghoulies off. Right? Because how dare that guy off the radio say that I can't do exactly as I please? How dare he set a limit to me? Problem is, we're operating inside a world where the limits are pressing down upon us all the time. And it's only really round about now that we've started to figure out that we're operating inside a set of incredibly finite and declining limits. Now, the more stuff that we continue to tear through over the next 3, 5, 10 years is the less stuff that'll be available for all humans and other species for the next 1,000 or 10,000 years. We have an incredibly finite space that we're operating within. You know those James Bond movies where the guy gets caught in the room where the two walls are starting to squeeze in? You know, there's always elaborate ways of killing people in a Bond movie. And we're kind of finding ourselves in an operating space for humans that is getting smaller and smaller. We've already pushed many fellow species to the edge, and many of them will disappear. There's absolutely no question about that. And the consequences of them disappearing are really hard to measure. So I saw in the opening clip, which is very inspiring, and actually one of the English newspapers put it really nicely. A little bit late, maybe 30 years late, who knows, but this is a great time. And I will put it this way. If you haven't started panicking about this issue yet, it's because you haven't grasped this issue yet. There is no calm, reasonable, methodical, rational way to get your head around the end of our species, the end of civilization. But that is where, that's what we're confronted with. Now, round about now, people start saying, whoa, stall the digger. You've got to give people hope. Because if you don't give people hope, they get all sad and they go home and they say, oh, I feel listless and apathetic and I'm not going to do anything. So there, that guy made me feel sad. So now I'm not going to fix the world. So that'll show them. We've tried hope. We've had 30 years of hope. And 30 years of hope has delivered a doubling of global emissions. Because hope has become hopium. It has become another product to sell. The technology is going to fix it. The Chinese, it's their fault. It's this, it's that, it's the other. It's everybody's fault. And somebody else. Anyway, the future will deal with itself. We've been programmed to be optimistic about the future. And by and large, especially for folks who look like us in this part of the world, optimism has actually served us pretty well. But we've now found ourselves heading into an optimism trap because we have to confront ourselves with the reality that we have two roads ahead. One road is that we just continue to ignore the cranks and crackpots like me and steam on to near to midterm extinction. If I were a betting person, that's where I'd be putting my money. That's the most likely outcome of this because we're dealing here with a lot of, I suppose, expectations, a lot of conditioning, and it's very difficult to turn that around. So, the other option is, and I'm beginning to feel, and you'll have to bear with me on this, mild tinglings of optimism. Mild. They'll pass, I'll be fine. But the Extinction Rebellion is one of the first things I felt optimistic about in years. Greta Thunberg, I'm absolutely blown away. My own 16-year-old stood up on a rickety little step outside of Dáil Éireann in January and gave her first ever public speech. The kid wouldn't hear her behind a sheet of paper. That's how motivated her generation are by people like Greta. And that gives me, don't tell anyone, a little bit of hope. That kind of change. But if you think hope means bat, we're going to come up with some, you know, cheap last-minute fix to this that allows us all to continue our lives the way they've been. Unfortunately, that's not going to work. We've tried that, and that approach has got us to where we are now. How are we doing, Megan? Are we heading towards the gate? Okay. So I guess, finally and in conclusion, how many more best years in human history do you think we've got? Now, that's the question. That's what we have to think about. And there's a lot at stake. Actually, no. Everything's at stake. And yet, strangely enough for me, the death and destruction of the natural world, to my mind, is no less unbearable, no less agonizing than contemplating our demise. Because if we, as one species, through sheer greed and stupidity, couldn't evolve quickly enough to restrain ourselves to operate within a safe space, and if we, as one species among millions, end up completing the sixth extinction, then, you know, it's... don't get me wrong, I'm very fond of humans. Some of my best friends are humans. But we suck, right? And we've got to stop sucking. We've got to be better humans. We've got to be the best humans there's ever been, certainly in recent times. And this is where I finish again with just a smidgen of optimism. We've got to be better. We've got to wake out of the trance of consumerism and the dream that has been dangled in front of us and look around. The natural world is dying under our feet. It's going to take us with it. We have to stand. We have to resist. And now is the time. And from that point of view, it's a very, very interesting time to be alive. Thank you.
It's an absolute treat to follow the guy who says it's the end of the world. I never thought I'd find myself in that kind of speaking position. My name is Dr. Kieran O'Carroll. To give you a little bit of background of my experience and where I'm coming from, I did a PhD in chemistry at NUI Maynooth, where I studied, researched ways of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, and it was while doing that I realized just how absolutely screwed we were, and this was about 10 or 12 years ago. And I have to say, I got really depressed. I really struggled with it, and I got involved with environmentalist movements. And with that activism, we continuously lost. We got our asses handed to us. I still have some nightmares about Dutch riot policemen from an experience of the Copenhagen. They really came down on us extremely hard, and it just felt like loss after loss. And it's very depressing, and it's very hard to kind of get yourself out of that hole with climate activism. I joined, started working for an NGO called ActionAid, some of you might be familiar with, and while working there, we just saw again and again incredible disasters happening because of extreme weather events, particularly in Africa, East Asia, and South America. The amount of emergencies that we were having to declare was just coming off the scale for the organization in a way that we couldn't possibly deal with while the rich north continued on in its everyday existence. So it was really searching, as many people were, I think, for a new type of activism, an activism that was really going to make the difference. At the same time, seeing the dire warnings from scientists just get worse and worse until the IPCC, United Nations top climate scientists, declared last November that we had only 12 years to avert climate catastrophe. And that 12 years means we need to start now. We need globally to be reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 18% every year. Absolutely transformative change. And continue to just not see anything happen. And then, oh yeah, I don't have a clicker, so I was told to do exaggerated click for the back. So exaggerated click. Yes, another exaggerated click. Cool. And then something happened. Some activists blockaded the five bridges of London. peaceful civil disobedience and blockaded these bridges until they were arrested. And this was like a lightning bolt. This was like, finally, people are coming together and doing something. And then, of course, we had the international rebellion taking place across 43 countries across April, the most prominent of which was in London. Over 1,000 arrests. We held 5 sites for 5 days in the capital city. Absolutely incredible scenes. The police didn't know what to do with us. I had a bit of the surreal experience, next slide, sorry, of being arrested on RT News. I was actually still in my cell when this went out. So the first my mom heard about it was actually watching the news. And when she called me, of course, I couldn't pick up the phone. So that was definitely a new experience. I'm, you know, not someone who breaks the law. I've never broken the law before. But yet here I am finding myself doing this and spending time in police cells. Along with so many other inspirational people who I also were completely law-abiding citizens, from young students to grandmothers. I was on Waterloo Bridge on the Monday night at 3 a.m. when the police were trying to retake the bridge from us. And the person on my left was a grandmother who was 78 years old. And I asked her, you know, you confident about this? You good? You know, because she probably wasn't shitting herself, but I was. And she just took out 2 pictures of her grandchildren. She didn't say anything. She just showed me them. I was like, yeah, you're good. And on my right-hand side was a student from King's University who was there because she was studying climate change, and she just felt she had to be a part of it. So completely across generations and people from multiple communities coming together for action. And next slide, please. So Extinction Rebellion uses peaceful civil disobedience as a strategy, as a tactic, and it's not just the International Rebellion or the London Rebellion. We've been using it for some time now with bridge blockades, road blockings, council protests, symbolic protests, lock-ons. This is our strategy and this is our tactic. Next slide, please. But why does Extinction Rebellion use peaceful civil disobedience as our primary tactic? And I think it's worth considering that for the people in Extinction Rebellion, we've kind of gone through the looking glass. We've been through the long, dark night. And all of us realize that we looked at the science and gone, we really have one shot at this. We have one shot at turning the ship around, at major system change to put us back on course. There isn't going to be another opportunity to reverse the trends that we're seeing. We're it. And so what we need to do is get our strategy and our tactics right. We need to give ourselves the absolute best chance of success. And it may be a slim chance of success, but we still need to use the best tactics and message we've got and give it the best possible glorious try we can. Next slide, please. So peaceful civil disobedience, people think of people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And those are people that our tactics emulate, absolutely. But the reason that we use peaceful civil disobedience isn't because it sounds good or, you know, it's morally just. Those things are benefits and bonuses. But as I say, when you have only one shot at turning the ship around, at survival of the entire human race and nature itself, we must choose the most effective strategy possible to us, not just because some form of strategy is emulated or considered more morally correct in society. Or as I do say, that is a bonus. Next slide, please. So what Extinction Rebellion did when sitting down to think of its strategy is we went to the social science. I mean, we go to the science for climate change to tell us what's happening. So let's go to the social science and tell us what's the most effective type of resistance for mass system change. And Chenoweth and Stephen did an extremely important paper at the end of the 2000s. In fact, Erica Chenoweth originally set out to confirm the assumptions he had that violent resistance and violent rebellion were the most effective types of overthrowing governments and creating the change you want. But when she went to actually empirically measure civil disobedience and revolutions from the year 1900 to 2006, she actually found the exact opposite. Nonviolent campaigns were more likely to win legitimacy, effect long-lasting change, win domestic and international support, and compel the kind of loyalty shifts and system change that you need. Next slide, please. In fact, she found that non-violent campaigns were twice as likely to succeed as violent campaigns, which is really, kind of great research for those of us who think this is the morally correct way to go. Next slide, please. And she also found out that, in fact, this trend is increasing. There are more successful non-violent, peaceful civil disobedience actions working and having an effect than non-violent. And this is a trend that is continuing. Next slide, please. So for us kind of in the Western world, this, as Erica was thinking, that this is kind of contrary to one's beliefs. I mean, we see on TV all the time, anyone who's watching The Avengers or Game of Thrones, it's violence, violence, violence for people to affect their needs. When we look at our own history books or consider the kind of cultural revolutionary icons that we consider even here in Ireland, it's full of violence. So we really have to kind of, from our perspective, look at, for examples, in other parts of the world. And there's other parts of the world that are doing this far better than we are. The actions in Yugoslavia in 2000 to overthrow Slobodan Milosevic. Next slide, please. What's happening in Sudan right now? Peaceful civil disobedience taking place to overthrow their president, led by many women. And next slide, please. And the protests against Algeria's president that has led to his ousting. Now, peaceful civil disobedience doesn't work 100% of the time, but it gives you the maximum chance of success. Now, there's four key points you have to follow in the civil disobedience kind of rule book to maximize your chance. One, you got to go to the capital city. You got to get in the faces of the elites and the government, and you got to get them to notice. It has to be non-violent, because you need to bring in as many people to point three from across the community as possible. And also, anyone can take part in non-violent civil disobedience. Anyone that's trying to feed a baby that doesn't want to be fed understands that anyone can take part in non-violent civil disobedience. So it really grabs as many people and brings them to your movement as possible. Also, with non-violent civil disobedience, it's found that where it's rural, city, types of affluence, types of backgrounds, you're far more likely to get people to want to engage in it from across the community than you are with violent disobedience. So that's important as well for the kind of future that you want for your community. And four, very importantly, it needs to be more than one day. You need to take to the streets continuously, 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 and get in the face of the government and not let them move. Get them in their face, and you need to block business as usual, whether that be the military not letting them move around cities, whether it be the economic functioning of the city-state. I'd say London's a good example of that. That was about the tactics there were to hit the government and companies in their pockets and with the economy. Next slide, please. There's also a very important 3.5 rule of success. The research found that when you mobilize continuously, day after day, peacefully, 3.5% of a population, without fail, that revolution was successful. So 3.5% of a population isn't nothing. But in Ireland, we're already at about 11,000 with our school strikers. So that's a really good start. About 3.5% is about 130,000. But once you get to the 3.5%, we find that things really steamroll, and the revolution and the rebellion never fails. And so that's really, really an important number, 3.5%, and gives us hope. Next slide, please. So the international rebellion, I just want to talk about the tactics that were used in London a little bit, considering what we just saw. So thank you very much. So what we did in London was, as I say, we blockaded five sites. And that was to disrupt the economic workings of a capital city right in the face of the elites. We did it day after day, and we did a strategic escalation day after day. First day was about blocking streets. The second day, we blocked other roads. The third day, we blocked the transport systems to bring it to a halt. The fourth day, we were up in trees and blocking, even went to a Heathrow protest. So every day, it keeps escalating, bigger and bigger and bigger. And with peaceful civil disobedience, you really put the authorities in a bind, a really important bind, because if they arrest you, then you get more sympathy and you get more attention for your cause. And if they don't arrest you, well, then you continue to hold the street and your rebellion continues. So based on those kind of tactics, and our first demand of our protest was for governments to declare a climate emergency, coming off the back of that, Scotland and Wales have declared climate emergencies. And today in the Parliament of Westminster, Labour have a motion to declare a climate emergency in the UK. So to finish up, what I'd say is that we have one shot at this. this social science tells us that peaceful civil disobedience is the most effective method that we can use. We've got to go to the capital cities, we've got to disrupt business as usual, we've got to do it day after day after day, and we have to be strategic and we have to stand together. And we have to all come together across communities and do it together. Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening to another Queer and Alternative podcast. Don't forget to share, rate and review this podcast as it helps us get more listeners.
GCN, reflecting queer life in print, online and at our live events.